So, Ellie, this is our fourth interview, and we've reached the 1980s, an important decade for you personally. You became a reader in 1981. In 1983, you established the Research Institute, which has become the world-famous Lauterbach Center for International Law, and in 1989, you became a CBE. Could you elaborate on this decade?
Yes, well, gladly, because, as you say, it was quite a full decade. It was the decade following my return from Australia in 1978, and we dealt with that last time. So at the end of the 70s, I was elected an associate of the Institut de droit international, and I became a member of that in the ordinary progression of advancement in 1983. So in the 1980s, the first case I was involved in was the case between Malta and Libya and Tunisia. Libya and Tunisia were in front of the International Court of Justice to get a determination of the correct maritime boundary between them. And Malta thought that its interests might be affected by the judgment in that case. So it applied to the ICJ to intervene. Well, the ICJ rejected the application, saying that in any case, the judgment of the court as between Tunisia and Libya would not affect Malta. And it was so worded in the end so as to preserve Malta's position. So then Libya and Malta continued with a case of their own before the ICJ in the years 82 to 85. That was noteworthy. Yes, that was noteworthy in one important respect, namely that Libya, Malta was contending that the boundary should be determined by reference to the equidistance principle, should be equidistant from the coasts of Libya and Malta. Malta wanted the boundary to be further to the north towards Malta. So Libya came up with an interesting argument that the boundary should reflect what they called an incipient plate boundary. That is to say, by reference to tectonic plate theory, they could see that there might be an opening up of the tectonic plates below the ocean, and that the boundary should correspond with that. Well, the basis on which they advanced that claim was the evidence of two geologists from Amsterdam who were put in the witness box to support the Libyan position, and it fell to me to cross-examine them. Well, now, quite by chance, the Libyans had actually submitted an article that these two professors had written in which they developed their theory about this incipient plate boundary. And I misplaced that text amongst my papers. So I had to ask the editor of the journal in which the article had previously appeared if he could kindly send me another copy, which he did. And then, by chance, I found the original as submitted by Libya. And I compared the two, and I found an interesting discrepancy between them. In the article submitted to the journal, there was a footnote saying that the article had been prepared, that the authors acknowledged the assistance of the committee in preparing the article. In the copy presented to the court, that footnote of acknowledgement was missing. So I asked the professor who was on the witness stand, I said, can you explain the difference between the two? Why was the acknowledgement in the article, but not in a copy sent to the court. And he answered, well, the committee thought it would be better to omit it. And I said, well, of whom did the committee consist? He replied, it consisted of the lawyers acting for Libya. So at that point, I said to him, I have no further questions, because he had completely undone the authenticity or veracity of the submission. But before I came to that point in the examination, I had asked him about this incipient plate boundary, and I asked him, when was it likely to develop? And he replied, in about 25 million years, at which point the court found itself greatly amused. So that particular theory of Libya's did not go down well. The court rejected it, but in due course, it found a line somewhere between the Libyan claim and the Maltese claim. It was an interesting case. I had with me as a colleague Ian Brownlee, who was, of course, very good. So that was Libya-Malta. It took 3 years, one way or another. We had to deal, for example, with an application by Italy to intervene in the case between Libya and Malta, rather on the same grounds as Malta had applied to intervene in the Libya-Tunisia case. But again, the court didn't accept that. Well, alongside all that, we established in 1983 what was initially called the Research Center for International Law here in the university. And I have to acknowledge the major part that was played in the creation of that center by my three colleagues, Clive Parry, who died in 1982 but had been involved in the preliminary discussions, Robbie Jennings, and Derek Byatt. And they set it up simply because, not simply, but I think largely because they felt it would be fair to me to create some sort of umbrella for the various activities that I was pursuing, like the international law reports and so on. We had no institutional protection for these initiatives. So the research center was set up in 1983. Initially, it was nothing more than a name on a piece of notepaper. We had no premises, we had no money. A friend of mine, Edward St. George, said to me, well, I'll give you a building. So I said, well, that's very nice. It happened that in 1985, a house came up for sale in Cranmer Road in Cambridge, which suited our needs perfectly, since we obviously didn't have the money to start on our greenfield site and build our own building. So this house, number 5 Cranmer Road, came on the market, and we bought it. Edward honoured his commitment in large part. He didn't provide all the money. We got money from other sources, including my own college, Trinity College, and we bought number 5 Cranmer Road for a price that was then the highest price that had been paid for a residential property in Cambridge.
Really?
Today, that price would be about a fraction of what the house would fetch on the open market, but we don't propose to sell it. So from 1985 onwards, we had our own building, and we could progress from there. We encouraged scholars from abroad, and that's one of the major aspects of the activity of the centre today, and to encourage people to come from abroad, pursue their own research in this ambiance where they can mix with other international scholars, and it's been very popular. And we also instituted the Friday lunchtime talks. Each Friday in term, we have a speaker from outside who speaks for about 40 or 50 minutes, and then there's a period of questioning. The whole thing is brought to an end quite promptly at 2 o'clock to enable people to get on with their other activities.
They're very popular, these lectures.
They are, yes, they are. Not least, I think, because we give those who come a free sandwich lunch. This was the idea of the Friday lunches was largely the product of of Maureen McGlashan. Maureen McGlashan had been a pupil of mine many, many years previously, and she came on secondment from the Foreign Office as our deputy director for a while. She was a very capable lady, and I had asked Geoffrey Howe, who was then the Foreign Secretary and who was an old friend of mine, if I might have her for a while. And he said, yes, you could have her for 3 years. As we approached the end of the 3 years, I was obliged to say to Maureen, look, I think you have to go back to the Foreign Office because there's really no advancement here. We can't do anything more for you than what we're doing now, either in salary or status. And so she went back to the Foreign Office and very shortly afterwards was appointed as the British ambassador to the Holy See in Rome. And she had a seemingly very cordial relationship with the then Pope John, I think it was. But she was a great help to the centre while she was with us. And we had these Friday lunches, we had these researchers, we took various initiatives to procure some money for people to do research, not necessarily within the centre, but under the auspices of the centre. One such work of some importance, of great importance, is the commentary prepared by Christoph Schreuer on the ICSID Convention. So, as I say, the centre started in 1983, got its own building in 1985, and one of its early activities, which has persisted ever since, was the promotion of what are called the Hirschlauterpark Memorial Lectures. And we've had some very distinguished lecturers.
Including Hans Blix.
Hans Blix. And in more recent times, earlier on, we had Krzysztof Skubiszewski, we had Ava Eban, and so on. And eventually I myself gave the series of lectures in 1992, which was subsequently published by the Cambridge University Press under the title of Aspects of the Administration of International Justice. And those lectures go on at the present time. We've had some very interesting recent lectures from Ralph Zacklin, who was until recently the Assistant Secretary General for Legal Affairs in the United Nations, who talked about the work of the Security Council. And we've also had lectures from Sir Michael Wood, a former legal advisor of the Foreign Office. They make a very interesting series, as I say, all published by CUP.
Yes.
Then we move on in terms of professional activity to a couple of cases.
Sir Illy, could I just show you at this point, as we approach the Taba case, a photograph which Sir Derek gave me for our Eminent Scholars website. And here he is with counsel for Egypt at the arbitration in Geneva. And I find it very interesting that two senior academics from Cambridge were involved in the same case.
Oh, well, that case is but one of several in which Derek Bauert and I found ourselves pitted against each other. He, in that arbitration, he was counsel for Egypt, and I was counsel for Israel. And it was a very demanding case. I did really most of the case on my own, whereas Derek had some quite significant and competent support, and eventually Egypt won the arbitration. But it was a significant arbitration because it was the first and so far the only international adjudication in which Israel has been involved. It took place in Geneva. It was fully argued both in writing and then orally. And I did have some significant and interesting help on the Israeli side, not least from Ambassador Rosen, the author of the major study on the International Court of Justice. And then at about, even before, well, I think just about the time that Taba finished, we became involved in the case between El Salvador and Honduras regarding their maritime boundary, Derek on the Honduras side and myself on the El Salvador side.
Again, about that.
And this was in the International Court of Justice, and it extended over several years. Again, a very interesting case. Then, around about that time, I was made a CBE, which was very gratifying, and I became a bencher of my inn, Gray's Inn, in London. I'm sure you'll appreciate that all these things were not consecutive, but were going on in parallel. They overlapped. I mean,
yes.
Tapa overlapped with El Salvador, and that overlapped with all my work at the research center to administer that and to raise funds
yes.
for it. And so, also towards the end of that decade, I became involved in the peace negotiations between Israel and Jordan, and ultimately when the issues were resolved, they involved some interesting innovations in terms of the protection of vested interests of nationals of the one state across the border in the other state. Eventually, when the agreement was signed and the boundary was opened up, I remember sitting in a row at the Jordan Bridge with the leading Jordanian negotiator on one side and the leading Israeli negotiator on the other side. And then at the same time as all this was going on, I became chairman of the newly established Asian Development Bank Administrative Tribunal, which sat in Manila a couple of times a year. I couldn't keep this up for more than about 2 years because it was really very time-consuming. By the time one had flown out and recovered in Manila and had the hearings in Manila and then flown back and recovered in England, the best part of 3 or 4 weeks was gone, and I didn't have enough time to provide that twice a year. So I resigned after a couple of years. But I had very, very fine colleagues there, including from the Philippines, Judge Feliciano, and a colleague from Sri Lanka. So that then overlapped with another very demanding forensic activity, namely proceedings in the recently established Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal. That was the outcome of the negotiations between the U.S. and Iran to resolve the outstanding issues arising from the change of government in Iran and the seizure of U.S. assets. And so this tribunal, the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal, was set up in The Hague, initially with Judge Lagergren as its president. I was asked by 3 American oil companies to represent their cases in that tribunal, and I was happy to do so, but I said to them, there's no way in which I can do this on my own, and I think it's right that I should have associated with me some American lawyers. And they said, well, whom would you suggest? And I suggested the name of a firm in Washington called Pearson, Semmes, Crolius and Finley. Finley had been a pupil of mine back in the 60s in Cambridge. He was an American, a very, very capable lawyer indeed. And he'd gone back and participated in the establishment of this firm. Now, the oil companies had not heard of this firm, and they said, well, tell us about it. And I said, well, if firms like if two of the leading firms of Washington, whose names will come back to me, I'm sure, in a moment, are to be regarded as the Cadillacs of the law industry in Washington, this firm is a Porsche. And so my clients were persuaded that they should be brought in, and they did do a first-class job in very complex and detailed proceedings which involved, amongst other things, the valuation of the entitlement of the companies to produce oil in Iran for the next 20 or 30 years. But when one considers the price of oil calculated then and compares it with the price of oil that has now reached, which is over $100 a barrel, one realizes how unreal was the estimate that we were then making of oil maybe reaching $21 a barrel. But that was a very interesting set of cases. Unfortunately, this particular set never reached a conclusion because the oil companies concerned decided to settle with Iran on terms that were agreeable to both sides, and which meant that the oil companies could continue to operate in Iran in the resumed agreements. And then, at again about the same time as this, there was going on the another case between Chile and Argentina. I've already mentioned to you the case called the Palena case back in the 60s, which was a very interesting case where the tribunal had reached a result which was satisfying to both sides. The larger area was given to Argentina, but was mainly mountainous, and a smaller area was given to Chile, but was the inhabited part of the disputed zone. Now, the Laguna del Desierto was somewhat to the south of Palena, and the title there was the issue there related to the title to this lake and the immediate surrounding district. Well, it wasn't a very salubrious place. I remember visiting it, and I got out of the helicopter that had taken me to see the Laguna, and was immediately attacked by a ferocious swarm of mosquitoes, so much so that I could hardly get back into the mosquito and into the helicopter fast enough and close the door and swat those that had stuck to me. It was, as I say, it was not a very agreeable place, but it was a place to which both sides attached importance. The Chileans largely, because in an unfortunate encounter between Chilean and Argentinian frontier police, a Chilean police officer had been killed.
I must say, I couldn't locate this place on any of the maps, including the very detailed Times map in the Squire Library.
Well, it lies south of Lago San Martin, between San Martin and Mount Fitzroy, but it probably wouldn't appear on a map. Eventually, we had hearings in Rio de Janeiro, and again, Argentina won that. That was some disappointment to the Chileans and to me. And subsequently, there were further proceedings in which I was not involved, in which the Chileans sought a decision regarding the extension of that boundary in the glacier area around there. I've not seen a copy of that decision. So we then went on from Laguna del Desierto to a very interesting experience, which was my giving of expert evidence in a case in the Federal District Court in the United States, in a case called Valero Energy Corporation and Coastal States Marketing as plaintiffs against Nelson Bunker Hunt. This was in the United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas, Houston Division, and was in about 1981, I suppose it must have happened, or thereabouts. This was a case not dissimilar to the Rosemary case, which I mentioned earlier, in which proceedings had been started by Nelson Bunker Hunt, who had an oil concession in Libya, which had been expropriated by the Libyans, against Coastal States Marketing, which had bought oil from that concession but getting their title from the Libyans. And Nelson Bunker Hunt was challenging their title. And the two defendants in those proceedings brought by Hunt, Valero and Coastal States, then in a sense counterattacked by bringing proceedings, antitrust proceedings, against Hunt, saying that this was a restraint, an unacceptable or impermissible restraint of trade. And this was the issue in the Texas court. The defense that Hunt put up was that it was a reasonable action on his part, and that was denied by the other side. I was asked to give evidence about this concept of pursuit litigation, which had been introduced by Rosemary some nearly 30 years previously. And I gave my evidence, and it was subsequently published in full in a United States publication called The International Lawyer, which I think was the periodic publication of the International Law Branch of the American Bar Association. And it's published there, some 50 pages of that evidence, which is really quite interesting as to the origin of the pursuit concept and so on. And after I'd given my evidence, the case was discontinued. The evidence seemed to have been persuasive, and the case was not, so far as I'm aware, pursued further.
How interesting that issues that arose over 30 years ago should be revisited. Very interesting.
Well, it was interesting because, as I say, the issue had first been raised in the Rosemary, then it was repeated, as I think I mentioned to you, in the Suez Canal situation and in the manganese Sinai Mining Company case and so on.
Yes.
And it had many ramifications in U.S. courts, where the position which I adopted was not always shared by the U.S. courts. There was a very famous case called Sabatino, which was contrary to the Rosemary approach, but then there was U.S. legislation which seemed to accept it. And then there was a thing called the Federal Tort Claims Act, which also embodied the possibility of suing in respect of foreign wrongs. So that was that case.
Which
there
brings us to the 1990s, Sir Eli.
Yes, I just got one item still under the 1980s, and that was my giving of evidence in a very interesting extension of the litigation between the U.S. federal government and the governments of the coastal states in the United States. This one was U.S. against California, relating to the determination of their respective interests in the offshore oil deposits. And the particular issue was this. The United States government was entitled, or the state government was entitled to the deposits within the territorial sea of California, and the United States federal government was entitled to the deposits lying seaward of the territorial sea. Now, in determining the line between the two claims, the question was whether account should be taken of various piers that had been built on the California coast. And the Californians said that the piers should be taken into account, thus projecting their territorial sea further out, and the United States government understandably took the opposite view. And expert evidence was called in connection, in support of both sides. Now, the United States government introduced as their expert witness Judge Philip C. Jessup, who had been the U.S. judge on the International Court and was an outstanding lawyer, a man of great eminence, a very fine person. He'd been, amongst other things, the U.S. permanent representative on the Security Council, and so on. So he was a very outstanding man, and he gave his evidence in support of the U.S. I'm very glad he gave his evidence first, because I learnt a great deal from his technique of giving evidence, which was both exceedingly courteous and very clear, and I then gave my evidence. The evidence was given before a so-called special master appointed by the Supreme Court, a former U.S. appellate judge himself, and then he had to reach a decision in his report, and he had a marvelous footnote when he adopted my evidence, saying that he had had the benefit of hearing the evidence of Judge Joseph and myself, and if he accepted the evidence of one in preference to the other, he meant no offense or disrespect to the other. And so that was an interesting venture into giving expert evidence in the United States.
Interesting. So we then come to the 1990s, which were another very important period, was an important period in your career. In 1995, you retired, Sir Eli, from your directorship of the Lauterbach Center. In 1998, you were knighted, and you continued your very extensive international commitments. The first item on the list is AOI, and I wonder what this acronym stands for.
Well, the acronym AOI stands for the Arab Organization for Industrialization. The issue there was I was instructed by a very fine Egyptian lawyer who had, in fact, been the lawyer who had advised Colonel Nasser at the time of the nationalization of the Suez Canal. And the question there was a very technical one about the international standing of the AOI, and there were arbitrations, which I was not actually involved in, from which I was giving advice. And so I went on from AOI to another case in which I was the presiding arbitrator, a NAFTA case, a case under the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is the agreement concluded between the U.S. and Canada. This was a case about agricultural tariffs, in which eventually the tribunal decided in favor of of Canada. It was a complex technical case. I won't bother you with the details. And then there was another case also under the same agreement, which had been extended to Mexico as well, about the treatment by Mexico of a U.S. enterprise in Mexico, Metalclad, where we gave a decision in favor of the United States on the question of the legality of the treatment by the Mexican state authorities of this U.S. investment. And that took quite a bit of time. We moved on from there. I must remind you, of course, all along in parallel with all this, I was continuing with my university teaching and with the running of the research center and helping Christopher Greenwood in his mammoth task of editing the international law reports and so on.
I wonder how you managed to fit it all in, Sir Eli.
Well, the answer to that is very simple. I don't think I did anything else. I think I'm a dull boy, the product of all work. I mean, international law was both work and hobby, and also on the side there was Grotius Publications, which I mentioned last term. You know, one just kept on at them. I had very good secretarial help, and that's how one did it. But about that time, we began to consider the question of whether the nuclear tests case that had been decided between Australia and New Zealand on the one side and France on the other back in the 70s, we had to consider whether that should be reopened. And the basis on which that consideration could proceed was an observation by the court back in 1974 that if there was any change in the circumstances which might lead to atmospheric fallout on the territory of New Zealand or Australia, then the parties might go back to it. Now, throughout that period, although France had ceased atmospheric nuclear testing back in 1974, it had continued with underground nuclear testing at Mururoa Island. And so there was some concern lest Mururoa Island, subjected as it was to these continuing tests, might disintegrate on the next series of tests and nuclear fallout be projected atmospherically onto the territory of New Zealand and Australia. And so New Zealand decided, and Australia came alongside, that it would seek the reopening of the proceedings in the court. This was both legally feasible and politically desirable, because both in New Zealand and Australia and elsewhere in the world, there was a feeling that the French testing should stop. So the proceedings were started by New Zealand, and I was assisting New Zealand in this. They were unsuccessful. We couldn't persuade the court that this risk was sufficiently real to justify the court a finding against France. But nonetheless, it was politically very advantageous to both New Zealand and Australia, as demonstrating their commitment to environmental protection. You have to appreciate that in those days, the 70s and 80s, there was not the same understanding of or knowledge about or inclination to protect the environment that there is today, where, of course, it's a continuing major issue. So that these episodes at that time were part of the evolving history of international environmental protection.
Yes, I was interested to see your involvement in what has become such an important area of international law today.
Well, yes, and I have had some other involvement in it. Just jumping forward, at one point I appeared for the Irish government in making submissions to an English local government inquiry regarding developments at the Sellafield nuclear plant up in Cumbria, where we put some considerations very strongly to stop the Sellafield people developing underground nuclear storage facilities. And much later on, I was involved in the proceedings that Malaysia brought against Singapore in the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea regarding measures that Singapore was taken for land reclamation in the absence of any attempt at an environmental impact assessment. Malaysia attained a measure of success. Not that the land reclamation was stopped, but that it was to be controlled and developed in discussion with Malaysia. So I have had a continuing interest in environmental protection. Well, then, at about this time too, the extended proceedings between Qatar and Bahrain regarding the maritime boundary between them, entitled to certain islands, of which the most important was Hawa in the Gulf, were the subject of proceedings in the ICJ.
I noticed that Sir Derek was involved in this case as well.
And that's right. He and I were in this one together.
And I have a lovely photograph of you, Sir Eli, with Sir Derek, with the ruler of Bahrain.
That's
in the
right, yes.
Scholars Archive.
Shaking hands with Sheikh Issa. Yes. The relationship with Bahrain was always very cordial and agreeable, and continued for me right through to the end of the proceedings. I got a very nice decoration from the Bahrainis.
Do you have a photograph of that?
I think I probably have somewhere. I'll try and find it for you. But the Bahrainis indicated their appreciation of the ultimate success of the case by making a very significant financial contribution to the acquisition by the research centre of the house next door to the one that I spoke of earlier. Our first premises were on at number 5 Cranmer Road, and number 7 Cranmer Road, the house next to it, at that time belonged to my own college, Trinity, which was using it as a research student's hostel. And I discussed with the bursars of the college at that time the possibility of the college selling it to the centre. And the college agreed to do this. But the money had to be found. And Bahrain produced a very handsome contribution, without which we couldn't have proceeded. And again, some contributions were found elsewhere. And then we got the house, but we then had to put it into habitable shape because various changes needed to be made to satisfy local safety requirements and so on. And that couldn't have been done without the benefit of another very substantial grant from the Malaysian government, who appreciated what had been done for them in the case between Malaysia and Singapore.
Interesting.
So we really owe the physical premises of the research centre to Bahrain, to Malaysia, to my own college, Trinity, which made substantial contributions, and to a number of private subscribers, including myself. So now we have two fine buildings and grounds, I think, which are the envy of many.
Absolutely.
The only trouble is that they require maintenance, and maintenance costs money, and that's the difficult thing to come by these days. So we have the Gutter Bahrain case, which went through various stages, which I won't weary you with. It took a long time to procure an agreement between the two sides on the basis of which a question could be put to the court. But this was eventually done, and the case proceeded. And Bahrain was successful in maintaining its title to the island of Hawar, and the court, as that was an important element in the construction of the maritime delimitation, then produced a result which was acceptable to Bahrain and to Qatar, and the two states, which were for so long locked in international litigation, now have very friendly, fraternal relations.
I think I remember reading that the decision came under some criticism because it was said to have been steeped in colonialism.
I'm not aware of that criticism, and I'm trying to think, as you say it, of where there might be an element of colonialism. Of course, to establish the title of the two territories to anything involved going back into the history of the Gulf area, but that involved going back in part into the Ottoman archives. And then there was a very interesting question which did not have to be decided by the court as to whether certain documents involved in the case as produced by Qatar had been falsified. But the court didn't find it necessary to treat that subject. But colonialism, no. But colonial history, yes.
Rather that it upheld an earlier decision when Bahrain had been a British colony.
Oh yes, that was an element. There was a time, as you say, when Bahrain had not been a British colony, but had been a British protected state. And an issue had to be decided by Britain, as between Bahrain and Qatar, regarding certain parts. And that issue had been decided in favour of Bahrain, and one element in the case was whether that decision should be maintained, and it was.
Interesting.
So I've already mentioned to you the Hirschlagerpark Memorial Lectures, which was an ongoing series. Unfortunately, I can't lay my hands at this instant on who all the lecturers were, but they were good people and much appreciated.
I think the first one was Shapti Rosen.
Yeah, Rosen and Schwebel. Judge Schwebel gave very interesting series of lectures on aspects of international arbitration, some disputed points. I found a list. Yes, the first one was Shabtai Rosen on breach of treaty, and then we had lectures from Felice Morgenstern, who had been a Cambridge scholar and had gone to the ILO and spent her whole life in the legal side of the ILO on legal problems of international organizations. And this was followed by John Dugard on recognition and the United Nations. Then came Judge Schwebel on international arbitration, three salient problems. Then came Professor Meron, now the president of the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, who spoke about human rights in internal strife. Then came Professor Seidel-Hohenwelden from Vienna on corporations in and under international law. Then Sir Ian Sinclair on the International Law Commission, and then Professor Schreuer on state immunity, and then myself, and this is only listing the first nine lectures on aspects of the administration of international justice, and the series has continued with other eminent contributors. So then, as I say, that was all going on the side. And at about that time, must have been 1993, I was selected to be the ad hoc judge in the case brought by Bosnia against Yugoslavia, arising out of the breakup of Yugoslavia and the consequent troubles and allegations of genocide in Bosnia. This was a very interesting experience for me. Of course, an ad hoc judge is always assumed to support the side which appoints him. I found that a very difficult concept to accept. So, in the course of the judgment by the court on the first stage of that case, I produced a separate opinion in which I expounded what I understood to be the role of the ad hoc judge, which was not that of simply supporting the case of the side that appointed him, but was rather to approach the case just like any other judge, but nonetheless to ensure that the case of the side that appointed him was properly considered in all its detail by the court and was not just glossed over. And this approach has been supported by a number of ad hoc judges in subsequent cases. And I continued as the ad hoc judge in that case for about 3 or 4 years until, by reason of the changes in the structure of Yugoslavia, the original case came to an end and a new case was started, and Bosnia then appointed another ad hoc judge, a Bosnian professor of international law.
So you had been appointed by Bosnia initially?
Yes, at the very beginning in 1990. Well, the first decision was 1993, and I must have been appointed a year or two before that. Oh dear, it goes on and on. Well, then, at about this time, sort of in the period prior to and during 1996, I was preparing lectures for the Hague Academy of International Law, which I delivered in 1996 on principles of international litigation. I've been rather naughty because I haven't actually submitted to the Hague Academy of International Law the text of those lectures yet. And so much has happened in the international litigation field in the ensuing decade that I have virtually to start from scratch, a task not easily undertaken, but made the easier because I have the admirable assistance Dr. Chester Brown, now the Foreign Commonwealth Office, who is helping me a great deal in the revision of those lectures. And it is our hope to submit something to the Hague Academy before too long. Now, do you want me to go on now?
I would quite like to
break off
at this point. Next time we can look at...
And we can start at Namibia, Botswana.
Interesting. And then yeah. We can talk about your knighthood. I'd very much like to know the circumstances and any anecdotes you have of the occasion.
If you're asking me why did I get my knighthood, I can't answer that. I don't know why, except that the official statement was for services to public international law.
Yes.
That's all I know.